Hi, I'm Eve Rees.
And I'm Claire Wright.
And we are historians. If this introduction sounds to you like a confession or an act of sharing our addictions, well, you're right. We are here to tell you about our addiction to the archives.
So welcome to our podcast, Archive Fever, where each episode we'll be conducting intimate conversations with writers, artists, curators, fellow historians and other victims of the research bug.
We're going to talk to these archive addicts about what kind of archives they use, how often they use them, when they got their first hit, and what is their funniest, saddest, most frustrating and most illuminating experience in the archives.
And we'll be asking the question, what madness is this? Today on Archive Fever, we're talking to Dr. Billy Griffiths. Billy is an historian and research fellow at the Alfred Deakin Institute for Citizenship and Globalisation, and also an associate investigator with the ARC Centre of Excellence for Australian Biodiversity and Heritage. Billy has published in the fields of Indigenous history, political history, deep history, and the history of science, especially archaeology and anthropology. His most recent book, which has been getting all sorts of love, including numerous award listings, is Deep Time Dreaming, Uncovering Ancient Australia, published by Black Ink in 2018. Billy, welcome to Archive Fever, or Archives Anonymous, as we like to think of it.
Lovely to be here.
Billy, we'll get back to deep time dreaming shortly, but I'd like to start by asking you if you can remember how you first got the research bug. When were you first bitten?
Well, actually, my first true archival experience was with my first book, which was about a political history. It was the intoxication of finding out that all these documents about high-profile meetings between important people were being released. After 40 years, they get released. And these cascade of documents being released just as I was beginning research on a book about Australia's relationship with China. So I was caught up in this world of political intrigue that you could suddenly go into the National Archives, as it was then. You had to give all sorts of different documentation to show that you would be responsible with the material. Then to find out what happened inside, behind those closed doors, what happened that the journalists from 40 years ago were speculating about. And that was an exhilarating experience, and it propelled me through my first book, which was The China Breakthrough. But I also felt that was very much an archival experience anchored in documents of a certain type of power, certain type of history, and I craved something more and something deeper. And that's what led me to the research, which ultimately became Deep Time Dreaming, which has a very different sense of what an archive is.
So about that transition from being an historian to being an archaeologist, I saw that you once stated in an interview that what led you to make that leap, you put it this way, it was the thrill of chasing another kind of archive. So tell us what you meant by that and describe the thrill of the chase in the archive. It sounds almost erotic.
Well, I'm not sure about that. It's certainly, yeah, it's intoxicating. It's alluring. I suppose I had some big questions that I needed answers to. I'm not an archaeologist. I work with archaeologists and in archaeology, but I'm very much a historian and documents my discipline, which is why I'm so aware of their limitations. And the questions I wanted to answer demanded an engagement with a new type of archive, an archive from outside my discipline. It required a view of the entire landscape as an archive, as a cultural place imprinted with story that could be investigated with different techniques. So I pursued these, and one of the ways I pursued them was by joining my first archaeological excavation. Actually, I joined as the camp cook because I was the historian, not the archaeologist, and I joined this dig in Western Arnhem Land. Back in 2012, we went out to this amazing site, the site called Mudjet Bebe, which is a beautiful decorated rock wall leaning out from the Arnhem Land escarpment, a last remnant of the plateau before the landscape gives away to these wet, scrubby plains. We're based in this site for 7 weeks on that first field trip, slowly excavating our way into the earth, slowly descending into the earth, troweling our way through time. So it was engaging with a very different type of archive, but it was also an eye-opening experience. I could see how this archive was being used by our hosts, the Mirar people, who were actively mobilising the archaeological finds, the deep time story in their own campaigns against uranium mining on their land. So I saw this archive as this deep thing which took us way far back in time, thousands of years into the past, but there was also pressing in on the present constantly, a living heritage. Like all archives, it's a contested space. That's what underpinned the second book, I suppose.
I want to go to that book in a minute, but I'm really interested in some of the language that you're using to describe the experience, the pressing in and being embedded. And it's a very physical language. I mean, you're describing a physical archive, but you're also describing a very physical experience. Can you tell me what archive fever feels like to you? And is it different in a documentary setting from a physical setting, that actual experience of the fever upon you?
It's certainly a visceral feeling to be in a place and to be there with people who can reveal its secrets, who can unravel the histories that are imprinted within it. It transports you, really. It's a transporting experience. But I also have that transportational experience with the documentary record, and that's the parallel journey I take in this book, which is looking not only at the deep past and these archaeological finds and techniques that help unravel it, but then also working with oral histories and then also working with personal papers of archaeologists to tell very intimate stories. That's where you see a really interesting difference in the archives when you're looking at what was left over on a scholar's desk the day they died, swept up into a box. It is a powerful, intimate, emotional experience. You can't help but be affected by that. And as you work through their papers, you come to understand their very personal details, what made them tick, how their days were structured, and how their ideas formed. And that's an insight which is, I think, in some ways unique to the documentary record, to the paper, that, which is its own visceral experience.
Speaking of the structuring of days, I'm really curious about what an average day looks like on an archaeological dig. As someone who's only ever worked in kind of conventional paper archives, I just have no real sense of what it's like to be out there, you know, in the sun or, you know, other severe weather conditions, trying to kind of unlock the secrets of deep time from the earth. You know, is it boring or is there kind of a drama and glamour to it?
I think there is a bit of both, but there is definitely a mechanical aspect to it as well. It's a physical labour and a labour of love for most of the people who work on these sites. It's very much a team endeavour as well. It's all archaeology is done as a team. The day starts early. It changes, of course, with different sites. So I was just working recently on an archaeological site in the top of the Great Barrier Reef on Lizard Island, and was entirely dependent on the tides and when we could get the boat out to the site to excavate or to survey for stone arrangements. Dependent on the weather, dependent on how many hours of manual labour we could squeeze into a day. In Arnhem Land, it started early, crack of dawn, and we worked the whole day through to sunset, and it was like that every day for weeks. There is a kind of repetitive process, really, which can become part of your routine, but it never stops being this incredibly exhilarating experience. I find it exhilarating because you are uncovering with every scrape of the trowel, you're scraping away, especially at those lower levels, sometimes a couple of hundred years with every scrape of the trowel. What emerges is a history. An archaeological site is not a monument. It is a history that is recovered through sweat, science, and imagination.
I've never worked with a physical archive, never worked with trowel, only with pencil and pencil sharpener. But I'm really interested in something that you've said about working with the physical archive. You said a document always has an intention embedded within it. Someone's written it wanting to convey a point. Something like an artifact or sediment doesn't tell lies. It doesn't have any intention. It holds a story within it which is bereft of intention and influence. So what that sounds like is you're saying that artifacts are more truthful than documents. Is that what you're saying? Or isn't it always what we make of what we find, wherever we find it, the interpretation?
Oh, absolutely. All archaeology, all history is bound to the methods and the attitudes and approaches of those who investigate those archives. or in an archaeological sense, who create the archives and then seek to comprehend them. So it's forever bound to people. And yet also you're dealing with something much rawer. I think that's what I'm trying to convey. And it's not more truthful, but it's rawer. It doesn't have that layer of intention. The archive hasn't been cultivated for future reading. You're not engaging with someone who's looking towards their legacy. You are instead engaging with randomness, the discards, a little window on a landscape. As you're digging down, especially in excavation, as you're digging down into that place, you just see whatever happened in that tiny little square, whether it be 1 meter by 1 meter, 4 meters by 4 meters. You're only seeing what has come through there. And that leaves these huge empty spaces, these gaps in understanding and in knowledge. But you're aware that you're only capturing the margins, the fragments, where I think you can be persuaded, especially when you're working in someone's personal archive, you're seeing a fuller picture. You're entering their mind.
On that question of interpretation, one of the things I found most striking about your book, Deep Time Dreaming, was the real prominence given to science and scientists in dating all these archaeological artifacts discoveries that are coming up, which, you know, highlights the way in which archaeological research, the archaeological archive, is a real team effort, and it's a mix of kind of science and humanity. How does that kind of influence the research project, that influence of science and the time lords, as you describe them, who date the samples?
Yes, and we've seen an interesting shift, really, in the past half century, where, you know, archaeology is a discipline that straddles the borders between the sciences and the humanities. As it has been exposed to this dazzling array of new techniques, these chemical techniques, ecological, mathematical techniques, some of that ground has been ceded to the Time Lords, to those who can use the latest science to unlock certain secrets or certain insights. I mean, you see that just in the published papers. It goes from quite an essay format, familiar format, or archaeologists working from within history departments to papers that are full of graphs, that are mostly graphs. There is a common pursuit, and I see archaeology and history as mutually reinforcing disciplines. Each enlarges each other, but they also need to work together because there is a common pursuit of the past, trying to understand what happened and how is that relevant to today.
How do you also balance that perspective from science and the humanities when you are also engaging with, as you said before in your Arnhem Land research, Indigenous people who might have a whole other way of understanding the meaning, the interpretation of a rock formation or something that you have, you know, dug in that four squares that you have? Is there a hierarchy of knowledge systems that come into it? Where do you sit geophys against dreaming?
It's a wonderful question. I think that hierarchy really changes over the course of the process of creating the archive. The science is so dominant, and you can see that in the way in which these dates that emerge from these sites then get pulled into land rights campaigns or used by Indigenous activists to be taken seriously, as if they need some new date to establish what they have always felt and always known, that they've been here forever. So there is definitely a hierarchy in that sense. But I mean this transition because in the field, and this is, I'm not just speaking from my experience, I'm speaking from reading the work of archaeologists in Australia over the past few decades, fieldwork is such an intensive cross-cultural endeavour. The first interpretations come from the Indigenous partners with whom archaeologists are working. What's this? How does this fit in? If there's something that emerges from the pit that can't be understood, often the archaeologist defers to the Indigenous interlocutor, a person who's working with them and can understand how this might fit into their current life, what that means moving backwards in the past. The ethno-historical record, the oral record, the ethnographic record, these are forever haunting archaeology in Australia, forever guiding archaeology in Australia. They take preeminence at first, I would say. And then as the process continues and as you get further away from the pit and into the articles, that knowledge is kind of subsumed, is lost, disguised even. And then it becomes the Western authorial voice.
Is that changing at all? Like, are there Aboriginal people coming into archaeology as a field and kind of embedding Aboriginal knowledge in archaeological practices?
Absolutely. Yeah. And archaeology today is a much more collaborative endeavor than it was even 20 years ago. It is not just done in partnership with Indigenous custodians, but the questions, the research agenda is set often by those communities. They have questions they want to find out about the past and then are actively involved in every step of the process.
Is there scope to bring in Aboriginal epistemologies more to archaeological research and writing?
Absolutely. And I also think there's much further we can go in terms of bringing Indigenous epistemologies and archaeology together. And there is wonderful work that's happening, not enough. And there are no Indigenous archaeologists currently employed in universities at the moment, although the field is full of them. So there's so much more that needs to happen on that front. I can just see the power of Indigenous knowledge and experience as the way to understand and shape both the material record and then bring that into understandings of oral histories. We have some really exciting work that's looking at oral histories and the geological events that are preserved in historical memory of certain Indigenous oral traditions. And that's a different type of archival, again. So while people have been in Australia, there have been these massive environmental changes. So 65,000 years in that time, the sea level has risen by not 1 or 2 metres, but by 125 metres. And these were transformations that were experienced and then preserved in historical memory. We've seen dune fields form and volcanoes erupt. And again, these can be pinned down to certain oral traditions. The most often invoked example is where hills become islands and their memories of being able to walk out to a place that you can no longer walk to. There's no debate about the integrity of these oral histories, but there is debate about what events are they observing, what events are they recording. And there you have some estimates saying that these are memories that have survived 15,000 years. Others say the water and the land is constantly in flux and certain areas might have been cut off or might have been easier to walk according to the shifting of the dunes below the sea or the sandbars, which then seal up a place. So Port Phillip Bay, for example, you once had the Yarra River, the Birriyung, coming out through the bay when the bay was a hunting ground, through the Heads and out onto the Bassian Plain. And this was as recently as 10,000 years ago when you could walk from Tasmania through to Port Moresby. So do stories of the hunting plains that is now the bay, do they date from 10,000 years ago, 8,000 years ago, 7,000 years ago? Or because the bay is so thin, what if a sandbar blocked that bay off and you were able to walk out to Barwon Heads, which what seems you might have been able to do only a couple of thousand years ago? There's no doubting the integrity of the oral tradition has this as a hunting plain, but there is also debates about the dates.
So, Billy, you've reflected on the racialized power dynamic inherent in the archive or interpreting the archive. I don't want to put you on the spot as kind of the bloke in the room, but I'd like to explore what I sort of think of as the Indiana Jones effect.
Yeah.
The notion that archaeologists are rugged, intrepid researchers whose tools are sweat and risk and a dashing hat, whereas historians are more often kind of a fate. They don't like to get their hands dirty. And there's quite a gendered aspect of that. Is there anything to my theory, this kind of muscular and quite masculine glamour of the archaeologist's work?
It's interesting you say that because, of course, there's machismo in archaeology. It saturates parts of it. And the Indiana Jones effect was around long before Indiana Jones. Side note, Indiana Jones was a shocking archaeologist, looted left, right and centre. But within archaeology, there are different forms of archaeology, which are also become quite gendered, especially in Australia. There is the glamorous, the big dates, the hunt for the oldest sites, the coldest places, the hottest places.
My date's bigger than your date.
Exactly. My Pleistocene sequence is bigger than your Pleistocene sequence. Very much dominated by the cowboys and cowgirls, but mainly the cowboys of the discipline. Another form of archaeology which has underpins our current heritage frameworks, but which has been championed mainly by female archaeologists such as Isma McBride and Sylvia Hallam, is the landscape approach, which doesn't hone in the most spectacular or the most dramatic aspect of a place, but regards an entire landscape as a document that can be read in its entirety. So these require systematic, slow, less glamorous, painstaking work to piece together a survey across vast areas looking for scarred trees and surface scatters, old ceremonial grounds and axe quarries, massacre sites and middens. Read those and piece them together into some kind of story about the whole region. What are the connections between these places? Not only how old are they, but how do they interact with each other?
And in your experience of working with the archaeological archive, do you have a preference for those two types of models?
I'm much more excited about reading landscapes. I think there was this one moment of archival revelation, very different to that political revelation earlier. It was flying across to Alice Springs and then looking out the window. We were flying over the Simpson Desert and saw these dune fields, just dunes corrugating the landscape. And the archaeologist next to me pointed out the window and said, "See those dunes? They're aligned with the dominant wind patterns from the last glacial maximum 21,000 years ago. There is a record of dramatic environmental change that people witnessed, experienced and survived and thrived in. So even in these harsh arid zones, the desert is changing. There are people in the arid interior moving from water to, well, making a home. And in many ways, the modern arid zone formed around people. They didn't move into the desert. The desert came to them." And I think that's a mind-blowing insight that comes from both the oral accounts, but then also this way of reading the landscape.
And has your experience of reading the landscape like that and kind of coming face to face with these, this evidence of dramatic environmental change in the deep past, has that informed your thinking about environmental change in the present and the future? Like, are there lessons here in Australia's deep past for thinking about climate change?
Yeah, I think so. There's enormous lessons to be learned from engaging with Indigenous knowledge systems, connections to country, future change to sea levels. How did people respond in the past? What can we learn from that? Probably the biggest example that comes to mind is the ways in which the continent or the countries, many, many countries within the continent, have been managed by fire sticks, by digging sticks, and the ways in which Indigenous peoples have learnt to manage that landscape. One of the great challenges we face in Australia in terms of climate change is increasing exposure to fire and big fires, firestorms. We can learn from the ways in which Indigenous peoples have managed vegetation, lived with fire for millennia and used it for their own means. That can inform the way we manage our landscapes today, our vegetation, our forest, our bush land today, and minimise these massive fires. But also, again, this comes to a more profound point, which is to have a shift in perspective, to not see ourselves as outside our environment, but as an intimate part of it. And I think that's the key insight that will help us deal with the crises of climate change.
Billy, one of the themes that's come up over and over in our discussions for Archive Viva is an idea of the ethics of the archive. Mm. And it seemed to me that a large part of the story that Deep Time Dreaming tells is about Aboriginal communities' attempts to take control over their cultural information and access to their land, which are often one and the same thing. So should the physical archive be open and accessible to anyone, just as theoretically anyone could go into the National Archives of Australia or the State Library and start digging through the files? Can anybody just go and start digging on country?
Oh, absolutely not. I say that so forcefully now, and that's a revelation that's come about in the past half century. When you look back in the 60s, 50s, archaeologists went about their work without consulting Indigenous peoples for the most part, or seeking them out even to.
So the archive was just there for the taking.
It was there for the taking. And it is there for the taking in other countries, but in Australia it can't work that way anymore. And that is the legacy of this incredible groundswell of Indigenous activism, these powerful leaders who have stood up for their heritage and urged for a chance to have a voice in the decision-making about their land and their heritage. Yeah, in the book I really try and tell the story of some of these wonderful people who have set archaeological agendas and also shaped the way that heritage is practiced in Australia, such as Alice Kelly and Frank Gamanamana, Rosalind Langford. They're speaking on behalf of many others as well, who have fought to ensure that there is a degree of respect and understanding that you can't just blithely walk across a landscape and enter it, uncover its secrets, if you're not invited to, if you're not allowed there. And if you look back at the comparison I made at the beginning with this National Archives of Australia, which has these strict rules on who can come in, and you've got this 40-year window about when you can look at certain files, there are just as strict rules about control of knowledge. In fact, far stricter rules, far more intricate rules about who can know certain things in Indigenous societies.
So can we really see those Indigenous leaders and activists as archivists?
The Indigenous novelist Alexis Wright describes the land, seas and sky and atmosphere of Australia as the world's oldest library under the custodianship of ancestors. I think that's a beautiful thought, and it really conveys so much. Archivists, perhaps. I mean, I'd hesitate to extend the archive, again, this Western concept, too far. There are strong feelings about archives, and they're not neutral spaces. They are contested spaces. But to the degree that the power lies in their hands, yes.
Billy, it's great to think of the archive as a contested space, not a neutral space. But we also know that it can be a very strange space. So I'm going to ask you, in our sort of summing up, can you tell us what is the weirdest or most memorable thing that you've encountered in the archive, either as an historian or as an archaeologist?
Strangely enough, something comes immediately to mind. It is not in Australia, it's in Cambridge. A very eminent archaeologist whose papers I consulted, he had a habit of writing his own obituary every few months.
Every few months.
This is how I shall be remembered. And he wrote in third person and said, I was glorious and yada, yada, yada. It was such a revealing insight into the man. And then that comes back to this broader question about truthfulness of archives. There he is speaking to me. He is addressing his legacy. He's thinking about how he's going to be remembered. It matters a lot.
And did any of those obituaries get used?
I think a version of one of them was sent to his close colleague, so maybe.
Well, it strikes me that that's kind of like us curating our own social media presence. Maybe that's just what that fellow was doing, but in a slightly more morbid way.
Maybe, yeah.
And another question, Billy, that we've been asking all our guests, do you have a dirty little archive secret?
Well, I don't have a story to share of my own, but there is, it comes to mind, this box, or actually a series of boxes at Lake Mungo, full of artifacts, stone tools that tourists have picked up over the years from the archive of the lakeshore. And then when they get home, they get spooked about what they might have brought upon them. So they pop it in the mail back to Lake Mungo. And of course, once it goes back there, it's lost its context.
A conscience box.
Yeah, a conscience box.
Well, thank you so much, Billy, for coming in and joining us in the archive box here today.
And if you'd like to learn more about Billy's work, you can follow him on Twitter at Billy_Griffiths. So until next time, I'm Eve Rees.
And I'm Claire Wright. And you've been listening to Archive Fever, a La Trobe University podcast recorded and produced by Matt Smith on Wurundjeri land. Wurundjeri's sovereignty was never ceded, and we pay our respects to their elders past, present and emerging.
You can subscribe to this podcast on Apple Podcasts or wherever you choose to listen. Our theme music is by Poddington Bear, and you can hear more at soundofpicture.com.
You can follow Eve on Twitter at Eve Rees.
And you can follow Claire on Twitter at Claire A. Wright or on Instagram at Claire Wright Historian.
Coming up on the next episode.
There were thousands of responses, mainly printouts of emails. I had to stop reading them, the level of misogyny and ageism. And it was just like, oh, far out. You know, I thought I probably don't need to read every single word here. I mentioned that to Jermaine Greer and she said, well, you did more than me because I didn't read them.